The oneness verse, huh? The Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma verse. Let's see, so verse 8. So we all have our books here. Is this your first time here? You two gentlemen that you just came in, is this your first time to the temple here? No? Can you give them an Isha Upanishad? Yeah. So let's see, verse 8. Oh, I like this verse because it talks about Krishna's body. He doesn't have any veins. Yeah, no veins. No mechanics. Page 55, mantra 8. Saparya gach chukram akayam avranam ashnaviram sudam apapa vidam kavir manishi paribur swayambur yatat ta yato yata vyadadach chasvatibhya samabhya. Sa, that person, pariyagat, must know in fact, sukram, the omnipotent one, akayam, unembodied, avranam, without reproach, ashnaviram, without veins, sudam, antiseptic, apapavidam, prophylactic. Does everyone know what prophylactic means?
Yeah.
Go ahead. We need to pass the microphone around because we're on international television.
We do to prevent some difficulties, some diseases.
For example,
if we are getting sick with nausea, we use neti pot prophylactically,
uh-huh,
just to get rid of some mucus.
So it's usually something you do beforehand to prevent, yeah, you forgetting something, right? So vaccinations. Yeah. Or I remember when I was working, I had a part-time job transferring patients who were very sick by airplane from like one hospital to another, like somebody who had a heart attack was in one hospital, like some rural hospital somewhere, but they didn't have advanced care, so that patient would have to go to like a bigger hospital. So like I'd fly in a small plane to Reno, say for example, pick up this patient and take them to UC Hospital in San Francisco. And those little planes were like, you really feel the G-forces in those little planes. And when I was in the plane, I couldn't look out the window. I'd have to take care of the patient, charting and, you know, taking blood pressures and stuff like that. So I would get really nauseated. And so I was told that if I ate ginger before I flew, that this would stop the nausea. That's called an anti-emetic. That's prevent nausea. So prophylactically, I would eat ginger before the flight and sometimes even during the flight. And sure enough, it worked. Worked very well. It was kind of a little hot, you know, and... But then my wife gave me these Chinese ginger that's usually sliced really thin and maybe with a little sugar and not quite as hot. Yeah, you know, you're shaking your head. Your doctor gave you that?
The ginger people.
What does your doctor give that to you for?
She gives it when I'm coming down.
Prophylactically. Okay, so that's prophylactic. So... So Krishna is prophylactic. So the Hare Krishna mantra is prophylactic. So if you're chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, what is it protecting you from?
From sins.
Material influence. There's a verse, how does it go? Kalir dosha nide rajan astiheko mahangunad kirtanad eva krishnasya mukta sangha parambrajat. It's in, from the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, and Malini Mataji is looking it up. You can find it in your sloka books. And this, it says here in the verse that the Hare Krishna mantra protects you from the influences of the age of Kali. Which page? 285. Do you have a microphone there? Oh, there you are. Why don't you belt it out for us?
Kaler dosha nidhe rajan astihi eko mahan gunaha kirtana deva krishnasya mukta sangha param vrajet.
The word to word also, Prabhuji?
Okay.
Kale, of the age of Kali, dosha nidhe, in the ocean of faults. Rajan, O king, asti, there is, he, certainly, ekaha, one, mahan, very great, gunaha, a good quality. Kirtanat, by chanting, eva, certainly. Krishnasya, of the holy name of Krishna. Mukta sangaha, liberated from material bondage. Param, to the transcendental spiritual kingdom. Vrajet, one can go. My dear king, although Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults, there is still one good quality about this age. Simply by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, one can become free from material bondage and be promoted to the transcendental kingdom. Shukadev Goswami instruct Maharaj Parikshit.
All right, thank you. So the holy name is Mukta Sangha. Sangha means association, and Mukta means to free. So the Hare Krishna mantra frees us from the association of the influences of Kali. So it's prophylactic. Krishna's name, Krishna's form, Krishna's qualities, Krishna's pastimes, they're all transcendental and prophylactic. So we're moving down this verse here. We just did apapavidam, prophylactic. So Prabhupada probably chose that word. And it's kind of a medical word. I'm just amazed at how broad Prabhupada's vocabulary was. He was a pharmacist, right? Yeah, so he'd be right in there with the medical stuff. So kavi is omniscient. What does omniscient mean? Present everywhere, knowing science, or nisience. Nisience is darkness, science is light, or to know. So omni is everywhere, so he knows everything at all times, all places, everywhere, past, present, and future. Manishi is philosopher. Paribhu, the greatest of all. Swayambhu, self-sufficient. Yata, ta, yata, just in pursuance of. Artan, desirables. Vad, vadadat, awards. Sashvatibhya, immemorial. Samabhya, time. Such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins. So Prabhupada must have added that in there. pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. Fulfilling our desire since time immemorial. So it's very interesting because, of course, we'll read all of each one of these. But lately I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of responsibility. If you look up the word responsibility, there's two words in there. There's respond, ability to respond. So responsibility means how you react, how you respond. And actually, Krishna, he's in our heart. And he knows, and we're one in quality with him. So he's Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means exist eternally. Chit is to be aware, to have awareness. And sometimes I've heard it translated as security, knowingness, and joy or ananda or bliss. So Krishna has all, these are the qualities of awareness. And so the existence is aware. So everywhere in existence, awareness is the basis, and Krishna is the basis of all awareness. And so we are essentially awareness, and it's always present at every moment. It can be experienced if we look in the right direction. So when we have a thought, awareness, our awareness, and the super soul who's omniscient, aware of everything, is immediately responsive to that. So if you have the thought of some fearful thing, you'll immediately have the experience of fear. And if you have the thought of, say, for example, love or kindness, just think of somebody that you love, or think of somebody that you just have, that you're naturally kind to. Just like when we see Gita, right? We feel kind to her because she's a little girl. Of course, if we were with her all the time, I don't know. We her mother. Yeah, but nonetheless, as soon as we have that thought, it generates a feeling. And this is all dependent upon consciousness. If you take the consciousness away, then there's no mind, there's no thought, there's no body, there's no nothing. So everything in existence, including our existence, is depending upon consciousness, awareness, and that awareness is immediately responsive to a thought. And so how have we created our life? A lot of times people think that life is doing them. They don't think that they're living life. They think life is living me, and we feel like we're a victim of circumstances. But when we think of our life, if we think of our life up to this point, our life has been so many moments where we've made a choice about something, right? You know, we chose to go to a particular school. We chose to take a particular classes. We chose to get married to a particular person. Either knowingly or unknowingly, actually, we're making choices by our thoughts, by our words, and by our actions. And the super soul is actually responsive to every little thought we have, and in a sense fulfilling our desire. Of course, we're thinking, well, I didn't ask for that, but actually, if we were always thinking about it, we did. So the thoughts we hold are very creative. So Krishna is a self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. Another thing this verse is describing is Krishna's body. And it's described as all-knowing. It's not mechanical. So our material body is very mechanical. Our spiritual body isn't. But this material body is very much mechanical. Although the mechanism is extremely complex and advanced machine. Even the heart is an extremely advanced machine. And science more and more is beginning to study the heart, and even within the last 5 or 10 years has found out so many things about the heart. And I'll just tell you a few things. Like the one thing I learned when I was in medic school, when I was studying anatomy and physiology, was that the heart generates its own electricity. I always used to think that the brain was sending an electrical impulse to the heart and causing the heart to beat. How many people in here think that? Yeah? Yeah. Just like in order to move this muscle here, without the electrical impulse going to the muscle, I couldn't move my finger, right? And if I had a stroke on this side of my head, I probably wouldn't be able to move this side of my body because the electrical impulse wouldn't be going there. But the heart's not like that. The heart has its own center of electricity, and actually the soul is situated within the heart, and so is the supersoul. It's situated within the physical heart. And also there's the heart chakra, the subtle energy center that's also there. So did you know that when the baby is developing, first it's just two cells coming together, right? The female cell and the male cell, and then there's two cells and they merge, and then they begin to multiply. And those cells are all the same. And eventually they begin to kind of differentiate. And the first thing that is formed is the heart. And science doesn't know when or how, but at a particular point, the heart is the first organ and it starts to beat. And they can't explain how that happens, you know, but nonetheless. And did you know during a heart transplant, when they bring the donor heart, you think the heart is still beating. They take it out of the person while it's beating. They put it into a solution, and it continues to beat. And then they hook it up to the new person, and it continues to beat. It doesn't stop beating, you know, on its own. It's like it has its own system. And so the heart also, now they're finding, and they didn't know this even 5 years ago, I don't think. The heart not only has its own electrical system that it's independent of the brain, it has neurons in it. The heart actually sends information to the brain, and the brain follows the heart. And the heart, you know, has emotional intelligence and knows things, just like the brain does. But the heart is actually sending information to the brain. Not only that, now the brain creates all sorts of different hormones, right? You have the main endocrine gland in the middle of your brain called the pituitary gland. That sends out a signal that makes all the other endocrine glands function, like your thyroid and your thymus and your adrenal glands and even your sex glands. The heart also makes hormones that stimulates the brain and stimulates all the other hormones in the body. And not only that, the heart, because it has its own electrical generator, it actually has an electric magnetic field. And with every heartbeat, that field like generates out, and it's like a chakra, but according to your according to your psychology, according to your mood, that field of energy can be either what they call cohesive or coherent, like a very fine energy that makes sense. Or if you're angry or you're depressed or you're sad, it's like an incoherent energy. Actually, there's a famous scientist in Japan. He wanted to show the connection between the mind and the body, to show how he wanted to show in a physical way. We know intuitively that your mood affects your health, and that the mind affects matter. But he wanted to show in a physical way that happens. So he did this with water. Because water is a very malleable form of energy that actually picks up vibrations very well, just like it carries electricity very well. That's why if you stand in a puddle, and you touch an electric, live electrical wire, you're more likely to get a full shock because it conducts. So what he did is he took water and he put it like in different bottles, and on the bottle he would label the bottle love, or he would label the bottle kindness, or he would label the bottle compassion. All these higher emotions. And then he would freeze the water and then take pictures of it with still photography. And have you ever seen pictures of a snowflake? You've seen pictures of a snowflake, right? These amazing, cohesive, geometric designs snowflakes have, right? So, he would take pictures of the water, that had the vibration of love on it, put into it. And these far out, geometric, beautiful snowflakes. Then he also had waters that was labeled hate, sadness, grief, like that. And then he took pictures of those water crystals, and they had no shape. They were all like malformed, and there was no coherence to them. So he wanted to show, and then what is our body? Our body is like 90% water, right? But we're putting out all of these vibrations from the heart, from our mind, but from the heart. And, they're affecting every cell of the body. So he demonstrated this kind of in a physical way. So anyway, the science has seen that the heart puts out electric magnetic frequency that actually can be picked up for many meters away. Now, I used to have this experience on Sankirtan, especially when I was in Japan. Sometimes I'd feel real frustrated if no one was taking a magazine, right? And if I was very frustrated or I got angry, I could see people start to walk around me 30 feet away. Yeah. And if I was joyful and happy, people were just coming to me. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't notice the connection back then. I knew intuitively something was going on. They're picking up my vibration, but now, even physiologically, this can be explained. Another thing they found out is that this is really amazing. It really amazing me, and I'm just studying more about it, is that the Earth has an electric magnetic frequency, right? And when the human heart is cohesive, coherent, it's the same frequency as the Earth. And so just imagine, not only is kirtan prophylactic from the influence of Kali Yuga, but when we chant the holy name, especially if we're chanting the holy name with attention and with ecstasy, imagine the effect that that's having on all beings and on the planet. It's very, very, and it's also, there's a law that when individuals come together with the same vibration, it's much more powerful than individually. And it makes it much easier for others to slip into that vibration. So congregational chanting is very, very powerful. And maybe someday science will be able to spread the glories of the holy name. So anyway, we got off into a little tangent there. Yes. If you have the microphone, you may.
What does it mean that the Lord is beyond reproach? What does that mean?
Can't blame him. He's not at fault. He's fulfilling your desire. I mean, usually when we get what we want, we say, thank you, God. And when we're getting what we don't want, we blame God. Why is Krishna doing this to me? But according to this verse, it's not his fault. It's our own fault. And when we accept that, that's being responsible.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. You know, my question is based on the discussion we just had. You know, when there's a heart transplant, and we have to understand that, you know, the jiva soul and the super soul are resident in the heart, and you're actually transplanting a heart, meaning you're getting somebody else's heart into your body, then how does a transfer happen? I mean, we know when a person is, before undergoing the operation, the person has some consciousness, he's aware of his, some past, you know, he's got some memory of what he did, and then he undergoes the transplant through general anesthesia, he's put to sleep, and then the transplant happens. When he wakes up, he still is able to recollect that he's the same old person that underwent the, you know, the operation. So my question is, it appears to me like it's the same jiva soul that's present in the new heart, right? So when and where did this swap happen?
Well, the person who was in the old heart, you know, got swapped out by Yamaraj, right? And just the vessel, the physical vessel itself remained. You know, but the subtle body and the consciousness, the individual consciousness, you know, went on. And sometimes when you know, people are near death or they're in an unconscious state, they often, if they come back, they describe themselves as being already out of their body and kind of hovering around, waiting to go to their next destination. And so, especially someone who's lived a full life and doesn't have a lot of gross physical energy left, you know, there's not too much holding the soul in that body anymore. But anyway, not that I actually know this answer. I'm just assuming that because the person wakes up with a new heart, still has memory of themselves, that means their subtle body is still intact and that same soul is there. And so the swap must have happened during the transfer. And some people that say, for example, usually when you have a heart transplant, it's somebody who dies suddenly and who is brain dead. That means they're just the brainstem is left and the rest of their brain is dead, but their brainstem is able to keep breathing going. You know, if breathing stops, then eventually the heart will stop. So, you know, the center in your brainstem is your breathing center. So as long as there's an impulse going to your lungs to breathe, then the heart will continue to get oxygen and be able to maintain itself. So usually people that are transplant patients, heart transplant donors, They usually have either a head injury or a massive sudden stroke. And so that if they're known to be donors, then the doctors will keep them alive. But there's the heart's still beating, but there's no more consciousness there. So that's kind of like the state they're in. They're like in a real limbo state. Or, you know, there's no way they could stay in that body. So, you know, I don't know the ultimate answer, but I know those things.
And then what if somebody uses a mechanical heart?
You're on national television.
Hare Krishna. I mean, I don't want to beat this subject to death, but, you know, there are people with mechanical hearts, right? And then they are able to survive and carry on with their lives. So the question here is, you know, in a mechanical heart, where is the soul? The jiva soul and then the super soul.
The same thing. You know, the life is not coming from the physical. The physical is coming from the spiritual. And even consciousness, you know, it's described as the individual soul as, you know, being 1/10,000th the tip of a hair. But these are all material explanations. The soul doesn't have a material location and is not in a material dimension. Yeah. And the physical is occurring within the soul, really, within the consciousness. And the consciousness is not dependent upon it. But the physical is dependent upon the awareness, everything. The mind also. The mind as well is not alive. The mind itself has no consciousness. It's also mechanical, but it's subtle energy. We're identified with it, so it appears to be alive, just like the body does. But the life, the consciousness, is always just as it always is. It's just the consciousness without the body, without the mind. And the mind and the physical body can only exist because of the awareness. So, you know, you put it in a mechanical heart, usually the quality of life is not so good. And people who have transplanted hearts also feel different. Sometimes they undergo a big psychological change. And also, they're not able to reconnect the connection that's there between the heart and the brain. Those nerves, they can't connect them. Yeah, they can't connect that neuron. So definitely there's some different differences going on from a physiological point of view. Okay, so shall we read on? So beginning with the purport here, I'll just read the verse again. This is Mantra 8 on page 55. Such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure, uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. Purport. Here's a description of the transcendental and eternal form of the absolute personality of Godhead. The Supreme Lord is not formless. He has his own transcendental form, which is not at all similar to the forms of the mundane world. The forms of the living entities in this world are embodied in material nature, and they work like any mechanical, machine. The anatomy of a material body must have a mechanical construction with veins and so forth. But the transcendental body of the Supreme Lord has nothing like veins. It is clearly stated here that he is unembodied, which means that there is no difference between his body and his soul. Nor is he forced to accept a body according to the laws of nature, as we are. In materially conditioned life, the soul is different from the gross embodiment and subtle mind. For the Supreme Lord, however, there is never any such difference between him and his body and mind. He is the complete whole, and his mind, body, and he himself are all one and the same. So, where in the Bhagavad Gita does Krishna describe his form, and where he describes how his form is different than Arjuna's form? Can anyone think of that? Not exactly. So which chapter? There's a chapter where Krishna gets into explaining the difference between himself and Arjuna. It's chapter 4. So actually this is the first chapter. Remember in the Bhagavad Gita there are 5 subject matters that are described. There's the jiva, there's the Ishvara, there's material nature, there's time, and then karma. So in the second chapter, Krishna is explaining about the jiva. And in the third chapter, he's talking about karma. And in the fourth chapter, this is the first time he really begins to talk about Ishvara. So let's look at chapter 4 in the Bhagavad Gita. Specifically, let's look, we can start out with actually verse 1, because it shows how the conversation develops into Krishna actually explaining how he's the Ishvara and the difference between the Ishvara and the living being. So this is on Bhagavad Gita, page 91. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Imam Vivasate Yogam Proktavam aham aveyam vivashvan manave praham manar ishvakave bhavet. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god Vivashvan, and Vivashvan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed it to Ishvaku. So that's how the chapter begins. Text 2. Evam parampara praptam imam rajasyo vidu sakaleniha mahata yoga nascha parantapa. The supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. But in the course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science as it is appears to be lost. Sa eva yam maya teja yoga prokta parantapa bhakto si me saka cheti rahasyam etamutamam. That very ancient science of the relationship with the Supreme is today told by me to you, because you are my devotee as well as my friend, and can therefore understand the transcendental mysteries of this science. Now, Arjuna's heard this all right. He's heard about how Krishna has explained this to the sun god. Now, and Arjuna and Krishna, they're friends, right? And Arjuna's thinking about this one. You spoke this to the sun god? Say that again? So then we have Arjuna Uvacha. Aparam bhavato janma, param janma vashishya vivasvata. Katam etad vijaniyam tvam adau proktavam iti. Arjuna said, the sun god Vivashvan is senior by birth to you. It means like he's way older than you. How am I to understand that in the beginning you instructed the science to him? It's a nice question. So because of this question, now Krishna has the opportunity to explain the difference between Ishvara and Jiva. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Bahuni me vyatitani janmani tava charjuna tanyaham veda sarvani natvam veta parantapa. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, many, many births both you and I have passed, I can remember all of them, but you cannot, O subduer of the enemy. So here's one distinction between Jiva and Ishvara, which is mentioned in this verse also of Ishopanishad, because Prabhupada made the point that we are forced to take birth, but Krishna is not. So this is one distinction. Next distinction, now Krishna is really getting into explaining how the difference between his transcendental body and a material body. Text 6. Ajopisan avyatma bhutanam ishvaropisan prakritam swam adishtaya samavami atmamayaya. Although I am unborn, okay, he's unborn, and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all living entities, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. So now Krishna's explaining about his transcendental body. He's saying that it's unborn. That means it doesn't have a beginning. That means it doesn't have an end. Our material forms, every form, every material form, has a beginning and an end. The consciousness, the awareness that we are, doesn't. But the mind and the material body have a beginning and an end. So that's one distinction. And he says, avyaya means without deterioration. It doesn't get old. Bhutanam Ishvara. I'm the Lord of everyone who is born. So I'm controlling everyone. And he's prakritim in the transcendental form, swam of myself, adishtaya, being so situated, sambhavami, I do incarnate, atmamayaya, by my internal energy. So he comes out of his own will. He doesn't come because he's forced. And when he comes in his original spiritual body. He doesn't assume a material body, but he comes directly in his spiritual form. So this is the first point in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is really not only explaining about his form, but he's also explaining about how he's the Ishvara. Up until this point, the subject doesn't really come up. And then, of course, it doesn't come up again really until chapter 7 and chapter 8, 9, 10 and 11, and then Krishna is explaining all about Ishvara and how he's the Ishvara. So just comparing this to Bhagavad Gita, so we're just reading the first paragraph of the purport where it's being explained how Krishna appears, but not in a material body. He doesn't have veins or arteries or a pump. No pumps. So any questions up till now or comments? Okay.
The word-by-word meaning and the translation is slightly different.
Well, you'll find that in one, especially in the Bhagavad Gita, or many of Prabhupada takes the liberty to. To make it a more, so we can understand clearly, you know. Because sometimes Sanskrit is very subtle. And for those who are very advanced, they understand these subtleties. But those of us who's not so advanced or first time to hear this, this is just for clarification. It's not really changing the meaning. It's just making the meaning more clear. So it's not, he's not really putting in something that's not there. He's just, what is there, he's making it, putting a magnifying glass on it and making it more clear. So.
I was also thinking that sometimes Prabhupada does it out of reverence to Krishna, because the verse that you're reading about where Arjun says that Vivashwan is so much more senior than you are, actually in the verse it says that Krishna is junior to Vivashwan, but he translates that to Vivashwan is senior to you. So that's the meaning is still the same, but he didn't put a negative on Krishna instead of a positive on Vivashwan that way.
Uh-huh. Nice. Yeah, I've never thought about that. Yeah. The other thing Prabhupada said, that he said that these translations and these purports are his ecstasies. So, sometimes, his love for Krishna, his bhakti is just coming out, and you know, like many times it'll say yoga, but Prabhupada will say devotional service, or which is true. It's not inaccurate. And because the ultimate conclusion of Bhagavad Gita is bhakti, and it supports the ultimate conclusion. Technically, it is still Bhagavad Gita as it is, even though sometimes the words are not exactly that.
But the meaning.
Huh?
The meaning, especially for saxophone player.
The Sanskrit word, each word have different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And Prabhupada using that to proving the point. One of the things I was looking in here in the beginning, the Shuddham is antiseptic.
Uh-huh.
And Shuddham really means pure.
Pure.
But it is antiseptic. So
yeah.
In order to prove that point, you have to use that word, antiseptic.
Mm. Yes.
Slightly different means, in order to prove that what is the basic meaning. Yeah.
So yeah, and so it's not an inaccurate, and it's also not, it's not mental speculation or putting in a different meaning. It's just deep. It's just deepening our ability to understand the meaning in a deeper way or in a variety of ways. And also Sanskrit is, sometimes you can, in liberty to interpret words in different ways too. Especially when you're trying to translate it into another language. And sometimes in the other language doesn't have all the meanings that the Sanskrit word has. You can't find it in that language. That's always there in translation. Okay, shall we continue on? Okay, next paragraph. In the Brahma Samhita 5.1, there is a similar description of the Supreme Lord. What is that verse, Brahma Samhita 5.1? Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchitananda Vigraha Anadiradir Govinda Sarvakarna Karnam. So in the Brahma Samhita 5.1, there is a similar description of the Supreme Lord. He is described there as Sat Chid Ananda Vigraha, which means that he is the eternal form fully representing transcendental existence, knowledge, and bliss. As such, he does not require a separate body or mind as we do in material existence. The Vedic literature clearly states that the Lord's transcendental body is completely different from ours. Thus, he is sometimes described as formless. This means that he has no form like ours, and that he is devoid of a form we can conceive of. So sometimes God is described as formless, but Prabhupada is pointing out here that that doesn't mean he has no form. It just means he has no material form, which is difficult for us to conceive of, because in our experience, all form is changing, including our own forms. So we can't imagine a form that doesn't change. In the Brahma Samhita 5.32, it is further stated, that with each and every part of his body, he can do the work of other senses. This means that the Lord can walk with his hands, accept things with his legs, see with his hands and feet, eat with his eyes, etc. In the Shruti mantras, it is also said that although the Lord has no hands and legs like ours, he has a different type of different type of hands, legs. Could somebody else read? My voice is going. Let's see. Who would like to read? Oh, yes. Dhammadhar. You don't even need a microphone, but you do for everybody else.
Starting with it. This means that the Lord can walk with his hands, accept things with his legs, see with his hands and feet, eat with his eyes, etc. In the Shruti mantras, it is also said that although the Lord has no hands and legs like ours, he has a different type of hands and legs by which he can accept all that we offer him and run faster than anyone. These points are confirmed in this eighth mantra through the use of the words like Sukram, omnipotent.
So here it's describing Krishna's body, how it's not like a material form. And sometimes it's mentioned here, Prabhupada says that in the Shruti mantras, sometimes it's said that the Lord walks, but he has no legs, right? Or he sees, but he has no eyes. So similar description in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 13. There's some verses very similar to that, where Krishna is describing the super soul. Let me look it up here. It's kind of in the middle. Okay, look at starting with text 13. Please, Dhammadhar. I'm losing my voice here.
Shall I read it, Prabhu?
Yeah, if you just read the English verses from 13.
I shall now explain the knowable, knowing which you will taste the eternal. Brahman, the spirit, beginningless and subordinate to me, lies beyond the cause and effect of this material world. Everything are his hands and legs.
Everywhere
are his hands and legs, his eyes, heads and faces, and he has ears everywhere. In this way, the super soul exists, pervading everything. The super soul is the original source of all senses, yet he is without senses. He is unattached, although he is the maintainer of all living beings. He transcends the modes of nature, and at the same time, he is the master of all the modes of material nature. The Supreme Truth exists outside and inside of all living beings, the moving and the non-moving. Because he is subtle, he is beyond the power of the material senses to see or to know. Although far, far, he is also near to all. Although the super soul appears to be divided among all beings, he is never divided. He is situated as one. Although he is the maintainer of every living entity, it is to be understood that he devours and develops all. He is the source of light in all luminous objects. He is beyond the darkness of matter and is unmanifested. He is knowledge. He is the object of knowledge, and he is the goal of knowledge. He is situated in everyone's heart. Thus the field of activities, the body, knowledge, and the knowledgeable have been summarily described by me. Only my devotees can understand this thoroughly and thus attain to my nature. Material nature and the living entities should be understood to be beginningless. Their transformations and the modes of matter are products of material nature. Nature is said to be the cause of all material causes and effects, whereas the living entity is the cause of the various sufferings and enjoyments in this world. The living entity in material nature thus follows the ways of life, enjoying the three modes of nature. This is due to his association with that material nature. Thus he meets with good and evil among various species. Yet in this body there is another, a transcendental enjoyer, who is the Lord, the supreme proprietor, who exists as the overseer and permitter, and who is known as the super soul. One who understands this philosophy concerning material nature, the living entity, and the interaction of the modes of nature is sure to attain liberation. He will not take birth here again, regardless of his present position.
So in the next two verses, Krishna will explain who can actually understand the super soul. What are the methods?
Some perceive the super soul within themselves through meditation.
That's one.
Others through the cultivation of knowledge.
Two.
And still others through working without fruitive desires.
Three. And one more.
Again, there are those who, although not conversant in spiritual knowledge, begin to worship the Supreme Person upon hearing about Him from others. Because of their tendency to hear from authorities, they also transcend the path of birth and death.
Yay! Thank you very much. So once we got started, I just didn't want to stop. But that's pretty much all about the Super Soul and about Krishna's position and how you have this kind of dual language, trying to explain how the Lord is transcendental to the material energy. And actually, He does have form, but it's just not material.
Yeah. Prabhu, I have one question. During offerings in temple, when we are saying that the Lord, all the senses, He can eat through the eyes, etc., etc., we discuss. During offering of the food, we remove the flute.
You remove the what?
The flute of Krishna.
Uh-huh.
So, again, we are going back. So, we are inviting Krishna to come with, through the disciplic succession, asking Him to come and have it. But then why are we forcing the material part of proposition in that? The bodily composition to that.
Because we're dealing with Krishna personally, right? In all ways. Also, just like when we're chanting His name, He's personally there. Vaisheshika probably gave such a nice explanation of the 11th offense in chanting, which is to be inattentive, and he gave the example of Keshava Bharati Maharaj. Sometimes they're talking on Skype, and they talk regularly, and if Keshava Bharati Maharaj is looking at his watch, then he feels like he's not paying attention to him, and then, okay, the conversation's over. So he picks it up, So, we should be conscious of that when we're chanting, that Krishna's listening to it, and if we become inattentive, then he's thinking, this devotee doesn't care about me, He's thinking about something else. And similarly, when we're offering food to Krishna, then we make Him comfortable. We, remove the flute so that He can eat, with His hands by picking it up and putting it in His mouth, although He doesn't have to do that. Then you could also say, well, if the Lord can do all of these things, why feed Him at all, Yeah, but this is the thing that ultimately comes to that, is that everything is one. The Lord is one. And everything is the Lord. Everything, there's nothing that's not connected with the Lord. There's nothing that doesn't come from the Lord. He expands Himself for enjoyment. So ultimately, it all comes down, you know, the form is for enjoyment. And it's not required. There's also the formless. We always talk about the form in bhakti, right? But there also is the formless. And we always talk about how the jiva and Krishna are different, and we talk about their differences. We stress that. But also the jiva and Krishna are one. There's never a time where we're not connected with the Lord. And when we forget that, we suffer, actually. So we connect to Him in love, in oneness. But at the same time, there's this sense of separation. But there is no separation. So there's this transcendental spiritual duality for enjoyment. And it's higher. And it's all by the Lord's will. So everything is really simultaneously one and different. It's not just different, and it's not just oneness. It's both. And so, when Krishna eats, we remove his flute so that he can use his hands, even though he doesn't have to. He could use his eyes or use his feet. He created the food. So really, what is he? He's eating our love. And that's what it's all about. It all comes down to love and exchange. And without duality, there is no exchange and there is no love. There's just oneness. What do you think?
To me, it's coming more closer like Mata Yashoda, you know, looking, you know, she understands probably, you know, and Yogmaya is doing tricks in making her forget, correct? But then she is treating, you know, okay, Supreme Personality, but then still she is trying, okay, I am taking care of my son. And those immense pastimes are, so similarly probably devotees makes more personal connection with the Lord. You know, because devotees sometimes love, you know, kind of, you know, forcing themselves on Krishna. Come on, Krishna, let's... So, probably getting into more mellow. And Lord wants it, so that's the best answer, you said, yeah.
Isn't there some pastime where a devotee is so much in love with Krishna, he's giving him Krishna banana peels instead of the banana, and Krishna's eating the banana peels? What is that? Does anyone know that story?
Yeah.
You know, this story is when Lord Sri Krishna goes to Hastinapur. Hastinapur. He goes to Hastinapur first to act as a mediator between the Pandavas and the Kauravas. And he goes as an emissary of Yudhishthira. But at that time, Duryodhana actually offered him a very ostentatious palace to go and stay in. But there was no love from his end, and Lord Sri Krishna could understand that. So he opted to go stay with Vidura, who is, a half-brother of Dhritarashtra and Pandava, and Pandu. So Vidura was a devotee of the Lord, and he and his wife were devotees of the Lord. Vidura was ecstatic that Sri Krishna came to honor his home, to be with him. And after the meal, he was feeding, he was so much in ecstasy that he was not paying attention to what he was doing. So he would peel the banana and would actually feed the Lord the peel. He wasn't paying attention to what he was doing. But the Lord could understand his mood. So he accepted the peel, and the Lord was eating the peel, the banana peel. So the story here is that the Lord accepts whatever you offer him as long as he knows that it's with love and affection and devotion. So that's what I understand. Mm.
Thank you. Nice.
Clear.
Very good.
Actually,
I wanted to also add one more thing.
Okay.
In so I was fortunate to be in Bhuneshwar for 2.5 years, and then few times in this annual Rath Yatra, I was there, fortunate to be there, and I was very surprised the first year where all these brahmanas who take care of Lord Jagannath, they have so close relationship with the Lord that they call him Kalia, and they were actually doing all kinds of even they were actually talking bad language with Krishna. To me, I was very, I said, what are they doing? They'll go to hell next time. And I was serving my Guru Maharaj there. He was doing some shooting of Puri Dham. And I asked, and he said, no, that's the transcendental relationship, and, they are enjoying that closeness. So they have the authority to, interact with Krishna in that personal capacity.
Yeah.
I think I agree with Prabhuji. I think that interpretation definitely has validity. But on the other hand, if you look at it from a human psychology perspective, there is a saying that familiarity breeds contempt, or you take something too obvious, Again, I don't mean anything disrespectful here. I'm sure that the priests who are serving the deities there are very purified and highly elevated souls. I mean, that's the reason why they're there in the first place. But on the other hand, sometimes, when you do realize there's an authority figure and you have established a familiarity with the authority figure, you tend to forget, as a human nature, the authority of that person. And sometimes you may tend to be act and do things that may not appear as appropriate, So now, depending on the relationship, the other person may decide to forgive you. Like, there's a relationship between you and your father. And so, he's your father, but he could be a very important person in some setting. And, but you forget the fact that he's an important person, Mm-hmm. You treat him as he's your father. He's very familiar to you. So you may say and do things which may be inappropriate. But then again, you expect his forgiveness and love.
It's a good point. And actually, it just made me think of... I was very fortunate to have a lot of association with personal servants of Srila Prabhupada from the very beginning of my Christian consciousness, even though I only had a few opportunities to have his personal association or render any personal service. From the very beginning, I would hear these pastimes. The first devotee really that I was under the care of was Sudama Maharaj, and he was Prabhupada's servant in 1969 for about 6 months, and then he went to Japan, and then I became a devotee, and so I was under his care. So I would hear how he used to serve Srila Prabhupada and some of the different pastimes. And then when I was in Hawaii, I was there with Shruti Kirti Prabhu, who was Prabhupada's personal servant on and off for 2 or 3 years. And now he's traveling the world telling his remembrances. And also I was with Upendra Prabhu, who was Prabhupada's personal servant in San Francisco. And then actually he was serving him when Prabhupada died. And so when we were all in Hawaii together and we were all living up in the Brahmachari ashram and we were sleeping together, and I would sleep right in between Upendra and Shruti Kirti, and I would get them going about telling Prabhupada stories, and we'd go to sleep like that. And I just remember Shruti Kirti telling me not once in particular, but he was telling me that how hard it was for him not to become familiar and to remember that he was a servant of Srila Prabhupada. And he said particularly like Prabhupada would his late afternoon massage. In the early afternoon, he would get a massage, And then he'd take a bath, and then he'd take lunch prasadam, and then sometimes he'd rest in the afternoon, and then he would get up again. But then usually before going to bed at night, he would also get another massage. And so the servant couldn't leave Srila Prabhupada or couldn't stop what he was doing until Prabhupada said okay. Just like I had the experience of cooking for Srila Prabhupada and bringing his lunch prasadam and his breakfast prasadam. And I was told from the beginning, you know, you bring the plate in there and then you wait for Prabhupada to tell you to go, or maybe he wants more salt or something. But you don't just leave, you wait for him to tell you what to do, out of etiquette. So I remember doing that, and I remember the first time I brought in his lunch prasadam, I sat the plate down, and then I was waiting for him to tell me to go. But he never told me to go. So I watched him eat probably for a half an hour. And then when he was done, he began to talk to me. And then after that, he told me I could go. And actually, that was the last time he asked me to stay in Japan and do service there. He'd asked me on a couple of other occasions as well, but that was the last time. And I just remember taking the plate out and walking down the stairs thinking, what just happened in that room? And it was very significant, you know, but it was going on. It didn't all hit me until I was walking out of the room. Anyway, so Shruti Kirti, at nighttime, he would be giving Prabhupada a massage. And Prabhupada would fall asleep. So he had to, you know, he had to keep massaging him until Prabhupada would wake up and tell him, okay. So sometimes he would try and wake Prabhupada with his massage. And he would feel so bad inside because he knew, you know, he was doing that. So just to illustrate that, you know, so we don't want to become familiar with Krishna or with the spiritual master. And if you're with the spiritual master or you're with Krishna all the time, you can become familiar, and you can take things for granted, and even in a short time, you know, it can happen.
Okay.
Oh, what time are we supposed to end? I know I always ask this. What time are we supposed to end?
8:00.
We're supposed to. Is it time to have Arctic now?
Yeah. Well, technically this starts at 8:00, huh? But usually when the lecture going on, it usually starts at 8:30. But Wednesday usually starts at 8:30. But
oh, technically it's at 8:00. But if so, it's any time the lecture. So if I stop now, could we have the Arctic? Or so they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes.
So it is explaining that he don't have a body like us, and you know, his body is more transcendental. But why is there any particular reason it mentioning in here that he don't have any vein? Is any particular reason for that?
Yeah.
Because it's not saying anything else other than
yeah. And in fact, we're saying that that's not in the Sanskrit, that the Prabhupada has added that in. So. Let's see.
In the word by word.
Ashnaviram. Oh, I don't know what that means, actually. So it says without veins. Okay. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. So it means without veins. So yes, it has a specific meaning, as Prabhupada explained really in the purport, that it means Krishna doesn't have a material body, because the material body is mechanical, and there's nothing alive about it, about the material body. It's a total machine, even though we began by explaining how, especially like the heart and the brain, is such a very complex machine. nonetheless, it's a machine with interchangeable parts, even a heart. Yeah, they're not to the point of a brain. So it's just emphasizing the point that Krishna doesn't have a material body.
Well, that so because it's not mentioning any other part, just vein. I thought it's any particular reason.
Yeah, just for example, vein is a total mechanical thing, and it's interchangeable. Not only that, you know, when you have a coronary artery, a bypass, you know, your heart has arteries that go to itself, just like we have an artery, right, that's pumping here, that's sending blood. You know, the artery sends the blood, and the vein carries the blood back to the heart. So the heart is shooting the blood to my hand, right? And it goes to every cell, and then it collects it, and then it goes back up through these veins. Can you see the blue? So the blue is the vein, because it has no oxygen in the blood. And so oxygenated blood is red, but blood without oxygen is blue. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so it's a total mechanical thing. Now, you have arteries that go to your heart because the heart is a muscle that also needs blood. It needs oxygen, right? So sometimes those arteries get clogged up with plaques and fat, and then you have a heart attack, or they get blocked. So they bypass those arteries. And you know what they use to bypass those arteries? You know, they take out your big vein here, it's called a saphenous vein, and they take that and they chop it up and they hook it in there and they make a little bypass. Total mechanical. Yeah. And we can change kidneys with each other, or we can change blood. And so the Lord doesn't have a material body. And you know what's something else? We don't either.
Just a follow-up question. But we also hear from the descriptions when Krishna is in the war field. For example, when Krishna was fighting with Bhishma Dev in the Kurukshetra war, Bhishma Dev threw some arrows at him and he was bleeding blood. There it appears like it's almost like a material body because the blood is coming from the Krishna's body. Mm-hmm. But is that more just like only for pastime sake he was pretending, he was exhibiting some blood outside just for the pastime sake?
What do you think?
That's what I think, yeah.
It's just an actor, you know, like an actor on a stage, right? Having fun and really, you know, all the props are there. And how does it describe, how is Krishna receiving those arrows? What is he feeling like when he's getting shot with those arrows? Like, you know, hitting him like flowers, you know, like you're throwing flowers of love at somebody. So, yeah, it's just pastime, and even, you know, the incredible forms that he manifests are all just pastimes, and they're all reflecting the love of the devotees. In the end of the Anjalila, where we find actually the eight prayers of Lord Chaitanya Shikshastakam, Nam Nam Akadi Bahuda Nijasarva Saktis Tatya Arpita Niyamitas Maranena Kala, Lord Chaitanya is explaining, actually he's just speaking these verses out of ecstasy, and Ramananda Roy and Swarup Dharmadhar are there listening to him and encouraging him. And he says, "Oh Lord, you know, you have hundreds and thousands of names." And then in the next verse, he asks the question, "Lord, why do you have so many hundreds and thousands of names?" And then he answers the question, "Because you have hundreds and thousands of devotees who love you in hundreds and thousands of different ways." So they're all, the whole thing is based on love. This whole spiritual duality is simultaneously one and different. And it's all there for love. It's all for the pastime of love. You can even say, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in the Jiva Dharma, that explaining why the living being comes to this world, it's actually, according to him, it's also a pastime of love, increasing our love for the Lord, also increasing the glories of the Lord. The living being comes here, forgets who he is, forgets his relationship with the Lord, falls into Maya, and then ultimately rejects Maya and turns back to the Lord. So that is an experience you can't have anywhere else. And it also glorifies the Lord. And it also is a kind of love. Yeah. And also, love means choice. Love is not forced. Unless there's the opportunity to choose, you really can't have love. There has to be an independence there. Without independence, there's no choice. So I can't force you to love me. I can't force you to stay with me. If I force, then that's dependency. So there always has to be that independence. So there has to be the choice between light and dark, or the spiritual or the material. But ultimately, it's all about love. So on that note, why don't we end and look at Radha Madan Mohan and chant their holy names and love. And, you know, Acharya, could you lead the kirtan or Damodar? My voice is like fading. It's not going to last. Do the Arctic? Oh, okay. How about Damodar? Right, there you are. You lead the kirtan? Okay, thanks. Jai Sri Upanishad ki jai, Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, all glories to some devotees.